This is Andrew, and what's your topic about this week, Wolf?
The rise and hopeful fall of subpixel text rendering.
It hasn't fallen yet?
It basically already has, but yeah. It's still, foot hanging out of the casket.
So this is not a topical discussion.
It might have a glancing blow to, what was it, UXKit? Is that what we're calling it?
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, that's what they call it.
Oh, yeah, there you go. But perhaps a glancing blow. I'll see if I actually talk about it. But. Okay, so for those of you who don't know, but I imagine our audience probably is pretty well aware of subpixel text rendering. But it's the idea of there's just flat out like addressing the pixels like black and white unit when you're rendering fonts and when you're rendering text. And that's pretty easy to wrap your head around. Anti-aliasing is when you kind of shade things and instead of just being zeros and ones and on and off, black and white, you might put, depending on where that font, where that curve would have landed in a higher resolution display than the 72 dpi-ish screens we have. We'll kind of gray it out from very light if you're barely touching that pixel, very heavy if you're hitting it, if you're should be filling that pixel. And that looked pretty good for a number of years.
Yeah, your eye would kind of smooth it over.
Mm-hmm. It was, and, yeah. I think it looked better in probably, I don't know, like I preferred the anti-aliasing in the classic Mac OS than I did OS X when it first came out. It looked flat out blurry to me for many years.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm.
So the subpixel rendering, this anti-aliasing was pretty much born on in the era of color screens. I mean, not color screens, but CRTs. And as flat panels, LCD displays caught on more and more, some clever folks figured out that you could actually take advantage of this artifact of how LCDs are actually laid out physically. And that it's not just a phosphor that's being lit up in these round circular patterns, that when you have RGB, a red, green, blue, there would be a column for red, a column for green, and a column for blue. And because you know it's from left to right, RGB, and there's different layouts, and you actually have to take this in mind if you do subpixel text rendering, is that the smart guys figured out, well, if we actually kind of mess with the colors, we could just light up the left pixel or just the right pixel. And so I looked at my Mac, and I think this is the case for pretty much all Macs, that the subpixel text rendering on OS X, it makes text look a little bit reddish to the left and bluish on the right of individual characters. And Sven Prost actually has a good a blog posting here from 2007 called Subpixel Anti-Aliasing Follow-Up, where he has a very interesting thing where he has this text edit document where he just types it the pipe character over and over again. And because it where it follows a different subpixel boundaries, and because it's such a thin character, it's obviously very red or very blue, and it looks all these different shades of colors. It's very...
That's interesting.
It's pretty comical. I actually had to go check, and right before recorded, I went to the System Preferences panel under General, and the checkbox is still there. I had almost had wondered if Apple would have removed it, but still there, that you can disable subpixel text rendering. It's called Use LCD Font Smoothing When Available. And that again, kind of, it's a tip of the hat there, that the only reason the subpixel text rendering works is because you know the physical layout of the LCD panel, of the LCD pixels. And I believe it's still to this day that if you were to plug in a flat panel display, like in a DVI port or a Thunderbolt port or display port or whatever we're calling it this week, I believe that will not get subpixel text rendering because Apple doesn't know what you're plugged into. It might be a CRT, it might be an LCD, and it can't take advantage of that. Now there might be more like metadata that goes on over the wire. I'm pretty sure with DVI it doesn't know, but maybe with Thunderbolt and DisplayPort, information might be present. I'm not too sure. But I do know that was a thing for a while, and there were various hacks of telling OS X, no, you can pretend like this is Apple right. panel.
Yeah.
So one of the things I learned about while doing research, which I shouldn't do, because I try to do the Syracuse thing and try to record ignorant, that what I was looking at the Wikipedia entry, which I'll link to, for this topic, is that apparently the Apple II is the front runner on this idea of subpixel rendering. That apparently, because of NTSC, never the same color. thank you. How that technology works is that apparently you could just kind of achieve the same thing, and apparently Microsoft's patent applications on the subpixel text rendering actually makes oblique reference to it, or at least calls it out, and then goes through pains to actually not say claim that they're doing it totally their own way and deserve patent, which it got. So I was so I could care so little about NTSC that I didn't even try to follow the technical aspects of it and how well it worked, all that. And although I did use Apple IIs, I don't remember anything about this. So whatever. That's a lot. I call this out that is kind of the forebearer to all this kind of mess. So the subpixel text rendering got its biggest hit when Microsoft patented and included it in some version of Windows, and they call it ClearType. And Apple then followed up with their version of it. And from what I could tell, they actually don't license Microsoft patents, that they somehow sidestep that, and I think it's actually might be kind of easy because you just can pick different colors or something like that. I'm not too sure, but anyway, it's at least not apparent that Apple's actually paying Microsoft money for the ClearType patent. So this all brings us to, and so this is the standard beautiful text rendering of Quartz. It takes advantage of the subpixel text rendering it has for many years, and everything was fine and dandy until we get to core animation. And core animation wants to take all the things you draw and wants to move it into textures and push it on the GPU and do final compositing on the GPUs to speed things up. And turns out this entire thing where you're trying to kind of shade things reddish on the left and bluish on the right, that's really problematic because we have RGBA, which can specify an alpha in addition to the red, green, blue, but we don't really have the concept of make it reddish on the left and bluish on the right, because that would require you know where the pixels land. And when you're rendering to some buffer to somewhere, you might not know that. And also, we don't have even the idea of this you can think of it as like an alpha for subpixel rendering. That's not in the data structures. So core animation basically said, you don't get this at all. All we're going to do is anti-alias it for you. And for a while there, you could tell the apps that were experimenting with using core animation, CA layer, for rendering their UI because the text looked worse. And not even just the apps, but also Apple's own menu bar looked bad, because was that like 10.5 that they started experimenting with the translucent menu bar, and they had to similar problems there, is that you had to you don't know your background in order to for this subpixel rendering to work. You have to draw on an opaque background, so that way you know what the color, what the shade of the color that pixels landing on that you want to color reddish or bluish, and you also have to know where that pixel is going to wind up exactly on the physical CRT LCD. And so core animation screws up both those things. So it turns out that you can make it work, and it was on the Coco. I'll link to the post. It was on it's a Coco Builder link, and it's not exactly obvious what this. I think it's Coco Dev mailing list. I can't tell what mailing list this was actually from, but I believe it's Coco Dev. And it was back in 2009, and it's kind of going back and forth about, hey, my Mac app is kind of rendering text weirdly when I'm using core animation. Is there any way to deal with this? And it turns out Slava Prestov basically found a magic way to do it, where even if you need to use an opaque background, and then you need to basically supply your own bitmap context. And when you supply the bitmap context, this is totally sacrificing goats here, that you need to specify a couple flags, KCG alpha pre-multiplied first, and then OR that with KCG bitmap byte ordering 32 host. And so this, and apparently there used to be a Q&A 1037 CG bitmap context create supported color spaces that used to be on Apple's site that I think I even read back in the day, and I think might have spelled that out. But Apple has since taken that tech note down and is totally not... Yeah, I can't find it anywhere on their site anymore. So fortunately, we have third-party sites like Cocoa Builder that archive this valuable information because Apple seems uninterested in documenting their own platform. So an interesting thing is that this flag is pretty Googleable once you know about it. The tricky thing is like knowing the structure and how you need to structure your code. And there's a Stack Overflow post on here that kind of gives you all the code you need to kind of layer things up, build up your stack correctly. So the magic happens and you actually get subpixel anti-aliased text even with CA layers on the Mac. And I'll include a link to that. But do you remember TWUI or TWI? I don't want to say TWA because that's the unofficial Apple weblog. But that was basically Tweety, Lauren Berchter, author of Tweety. When it got bought by Twitter, he ended up open sourcing his core animation-y UI layer.
Oh, no, I never saw that.
Yeah, this is the glancing blow to UX Kit. Because, you know, you guys think Apple's being all cool, you know, and what year is this, 2015? This stuff goes back way back. People have been, you know, Mac developers have wanted this type of stuff for a long time.
Sure.
And his, when I was searching my hard drive for these flags, that was the first hit. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's one of the places I knew about it. And I saw that Lauren had leveraged that. And it's funny because it also shows kind of an errant search and replace that he did. He in the CG bitmap context create wrapper he wrote. He has a link to the tech note and also the Cocoa Builder thread that actually calls out what magic you need to make this happen. But apparently the prefix they chose for this framework before it was TWUI ABUI, and Lauren or someone did a search and replace for ABUI and thus turned it into TUI and not TWUI, oddly enough. Maybe this is a kind of more the lower interface, I'm not sure, but that ended up grabbing Cocoa Builder in its crosshairs. It found the ABUI in Cocoa Builder and turned and broke the link. So I'll include a link to that just because it's funny. This errant search replace to kind of, you know, to take it from ABUI to TUI, end up breaking this link. But it's not that important. It's funny. So this all comes back to the idea that subpixel text rendering is hard, and because you need to line the planets in such a way that you know where these pixels fall, and also transparency is a big problem. You could conceivably throw all these textures on the GPU and then read the pixels back from the GPU when you actually do the compositing, but it turns out that the guy who does the old new thing, Raymond Chen, is that his last name, first name, whatever. yeah, Raymond Chen. There we go. And he wrote a blog post on this called, kind of a lengthy title here, Color-Aware Clear Type Requires Access to Fixed Background Pixels, which are a problem if you don't know what the background pixels are or if they aren't fixed. Kind of self-explanatory.
That whole thing is the title?
That's the whole thing. And that's not the entire blog posting, which you get it. But he does have a section here I want to read from that moving a bitmap is no longer a simple update of a sprite's coordinates and transformation matrix. You have to go through full text rendering pass, including a pixel readback, in order to figure out what the current background pixels are. And pixel readback for video memory is not cheap since it forces the composition tree to flatten. So all this stuff with subpixels and what we're dealing with here is that I feel it's almost like segmented memory on Intel's 3D, x86 style processors. It's like it's this throwback to a less advanced time that we have these really low res displays that we're trying to emulate. Figure out trickier ways to emulate higher resolution displays. And guess what? We now have higher resolution displays. Of note, iOS has never supported subpixel text rendering. It's
right.
Even on the old iPhones that had non-retina displays that actually looked kind of bad, and you could really see the pixels. it's simply not an option.
Right, and you know why? One of the reasons why it's not an option, right?
Why?
Because you turn your phone over, turn your phone to the side, and then even if it worked in one way, it wouldn't work in the other orientation.
Man, that's I hadn't even considered that. So there you go. You're in your keep for this episode.
I didn't figure that out. I read somebody saying that, but still.
And so what's funny is that finally Retina displays are on the Macs as well. But we still have this idea of subpixel text rendering, but I'm hoping that it goes away soon because the glorious days are almost here where you can forget about all these shenanigans you have to do in order to get things looking right while being high performance. And we all just can go back to the anti-aliasing we had in classic macOS, or ideally, but maybe I'll just kind of look really blurry on 10.0. but our displays will be so high res, we won't even notice.
Right. Right. That's the hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on a Retina Mac now, a Retina iMac.
You got one of those?
Yeah.
Those are beautiful.
So it's... I mean, I haven't really, you know, squinted at the text on it, but it certainly, as I said in one of my tweets, certainly the Yosemite UI seems to be very clearly designed to look good on Retina displays and large Retina displays.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if they took time to make sure the text looks good too.
Yeah, there's something about Retina display on the iMac and on the Retina MacBook. I wasn't a MacBook Pro. I wasn't really too impressed with it. And iPhones, I'm not impressed with it. But that screen on the new Retina iMac screen, that is darn impressive.
I do think, you know, because I've worked with a Retina MacBook Pro or MacBook. I guess they're just MacBooks now.
Something like that.
And I still don't like Yosemite on that. Mm-hmm. So I do think it requires a bigger display. But mm-hmm. Alrighty. So my topic this week is that I made a linked list.
Yay!
So this started, let me see, let me get my notes here. This started with a couple of, well, it didn't start, but I documented this with a couple of tweets over the last month where on the 11th of last month, I said, guys, I think I might actually have a legitimate use for a linked list. And then on the 17th, I said, I'm implementing the linked list. Don't try to stop me. And then 2 days later, I said, man, so that's why nobody uses linked lists. So before that, I had never used one in anger, per your terminology, Wolf. I'd also never used one in joy or in sadness or any other emotion. But I'd read about them, and I'd encountered them mostly in interviews. So I'm going to talk about that. Now, for those of you who are concerned or astounded that I could spend an entire topic on linked lists, remember, I'm the person who spent 40 minutes talking about tuples. So you really shouldn't be that surprised. Okay, so in interviews, I believe I've been asked to implement a linked list or to... I think I sorted a linked list as an interview question, right?
Okay.
And so now I've never used them before. I've never seen them in other Cocoa applications that I have written, Cocoa Touch applications that I've written. Wolf, you said you've used them some.
Yeah.
But I've see them, you know, almost never used them. So I think they're used in interviews because they are a little exotic, because most people won't have already used them a dozen times and will know what to do with them. But they're still considered very basic because they're a foundational piece of computer logic. So I think that's why other people kind of use them that way. So that they could say, well, we're testing your basic skills, but in a way that's kind of interesting or at least a little more complicated. Now, I personally don't really agree with that, because I think the fact that I've almost never used them, the fact that that sort of low-level, usually pointer logic is something that, you know, in many ways we're trying to get away from in Cocoa development. If you're being interviewed to be a Cocoa developer, a Cocoa Touch developer, I don't think it's a great indication that, hey, if you can, you know, you can ace that, does that mean you're going to write our programs really great? I don't think that's going to tell you that.
Yeah.
But it does get worse. Have you heard the linked list gotcha question? I think we've talked about this.
If we have, I forget what is.
So finding an infinite loop in a linked list.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Now, they have to compartmentalize it. They say, well, you can't already know the length of it, so that's not one way to get around it. And you can't use external resources, so you can't build up a second list and say, if there's a duplicate in the second list, then we know that there's something in it. So there is an answer to it, and I'm going to spoil that answer because I hate gotcha questions. And the spoiler answer is, when you're iterating through the elements in the linked list, one variable iterates through them one at a time, and one variable iterates through it two at a time. And if they ever are equal to each other, then that means there's a loop in it. Mm-hmm. Because you will either get to the end of the list, or they will be equal to each other. And so, you know, some people might think, I've definitely heard people thinking like this, that they think, well, if we give you this gotcha question, we just want to find out how you think. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's not really what happens in an interview question. You've got a minute or two to come up with the answer or say something intelligent about it. And it's just, you know, I can see saying, well, we want to know how you think by coming up with something you can really dig into. But this is really either you come up with the answer or you don't. And if it doesn't occur to you within a couple minutes, it's just not going to in those high pressure environments. So I hate that. There you go. Use that the next time you get interviewed. But in order for that to make sense, I suppose I need to go over the definition. Although, do I really need to go over the definition? Do you really not know what a linked list is? Do I have to go through it? I will do it very quickly. So it's a container, and the elements of the container, instead of being accessible by indexes or keys, are accessible only by references to each other. So each entry, each element in the list has a reference to the next one. And that's for a singly linked list. In a doubly linked list, you have references to the previous and the next. And so what you can do is you can start at the beginning of the list and you can iterate through them all, and that'll get you access to all of the elements in the list. If you are a doubly linked list, then you can go to the end and you can also come back to the beginning. And so you also generally have a reference to the first item and the last item in the list, or the head or the tail of the list. Now, another aspect of this is that they can be intrusive or non-intrusive. Mm-hmm. So this is terminology that I did not see in the Wikipedia entry. I only saw in a Boost webpage, so I'll put a link to that. Most lists are non-intrusive. Most people don't even probably think of them intrusive as being a legitimate aspect of this. And by non-intrusive, we mean that the actual data, the objects that you're referring to, are completely separate. They don't have any references to the list at all. And so each time you make a new entry in your list, you're allocating a little tiny piece of memory to hold those pointers to the next and previous, and a pointer to the object itself. If you decide that you don't want to do that, which I did decide, and you can deal with the downsides of it, you can put those previous and next links in your object itself. Mm-hmm. And that's considered to be intrusive because you're changing your class design for it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the downsides. Now it's baked into your class design. Mm-hmm. The other one is that now you can't have multiple entries pointing to the same object.
Yep.
Because that object is they're conflated. They're the same thing. And so I decided I could go with that, especially with the idea that I wasn't allocating all these little bits of memory for each entry in it when I didn't need to. Now, another way that I could have implemented this, my linked list, was using a mutable array, an NS mutable array. Because there's no foundation class for this,
right,
that implements, you know, there's no NS linked list or NS list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, considering that I've never used them before, that's probably a fine shepherding of resources on Apple's part. Mm-hmm. So if you use a mutable array instead, what you're saying is, well, the elements in your list are just going to be the regular elements in the array. Now, there's a performance aspect to this that normally inserting and removing things from a linked list, the whole point of it is that that's constant time, that's simple, that's cheap to do. Whereas for a mutable array, if you're inserting something to the beginning of a list, then you're pushing everything else further back, and that involves some cost. I think on Apple's part, Apple is probably very good at optimizing that cost.
Yep.
Better than we probably could with our regular code for that. So, and it's also just pointers, so it's probably not that bad to do it that way. So if performance had been my sole reason for doing this, I probably would have just used an NS mutable array instead. Although I did hear from someone that, you know, yeah, you probably could beat the NS mutable array performance with your own linked list if that's what you need for them. But the trouble is, it's not performance, it's the references that are going to be the problem. Because when you move everything down one slot, or up one slot, whatever, further one slot, all your references, if your references are by index, all those are invalidated. So you can't then refer to the 10th element, which is now the 11th element, exactly, without going through all of your refers and saying, no, change this about yourself, mm-hmm, to do that. And that, even though I actually found there to be a lot of edge cases about in implementing a linked list, and which is why I now consider the linked list to be the official container type of the Edge Cases podcast. That's our sponsorship, I guess, official container type. So it's got a lot of problems, but implementing it is still kind of probably easier than dealing with that problem. There's fiddliness either way. And so I decided to go with the fiddliness of a regular linked list. And that also means that I can't say, well, you know, the linked list didn't work out for me, now I'll go back to an NS mutable array or go to it for the first time, because their APIs are so different. If you were to make an API that would be able to handle one or the other, I just don't think that would work. So I think when you go whole hog for a linked list, you're really kind of saying, well, that's really what I'm going to use. I can't use anything else.
I agree.
Okay. So I found a lot of errors in my code when I did my first naive implementation of this. And they were errors primarily having to do with the beginning and the end, the references to the beginning and the end. Because what happens at the beginning, you know, if you're putting something in the middle, then you're inserting it between two other entries, and those other entries now point to you, and you now point to those other entries, and you're done. But when you insert something at the beginning or the end, or remove something from the beginning and the end, you now have to deal with the fact that the beginning reference and the end reference is special, because they now point to nil, mm-hmm, instead of pointing to something else. And you also have to remember, you have to update your head and tail pointers,
yep,
to those entries. And you would think that sounds simple. I found a ton of errors when I looked through it, especially because the last entry is also an edge case. Because when you're the last entry has before and after pointers set to nil already, but it's still an entry in the list. And then when you remove it, those before and after entries are still nil, but now it's gone from the list. And so that was, I don't know, that was another little niggle thing to fiddle with. So in the code that I wrote, I actually have comments which say, was head but now is not, wasn't head but now is, was tail but now is not, wasn't tail, but now is. And each of those is a separate little piece of code to make all that work. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. Now, the reason I caught all of these errors was because I added a lot of unit tests,
yeah,
for this stuff. Now, I had unit tests for all of the actions that were taking place in my application already that were causing the linked list to change. So it was pretty easy to put in to say, okay, as part of all of those actions that I was testing anyway, put in a little extra helper method which says, verify the linked list is accurate for the current state of affairs. And the reason why that's pretty easy is because the whole, you know, the linked list itself is it's an optimization. If you have references to these objects in any other format, which you generally do, mm-hmm, in your code, all you have to do is say, well, if I recreate the linked list right now, according to that other data, does it match the actual linked list? I found that to be extremely, extremely easy and extremely useful.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if performance were not concerned at all, then I wouldn't need the linked list at all. I could always recreate that data when I want. Now, but I'm not willing to go that far. I want the linked list to work, you know, when I ship my code. So, but it was very easy to do that. To test it. But of course, then I found all the problems that I have with it. Now, one thing that might have made it easier was something called Sentinel nodes, which I had actually, I guess I knew about from before, but it didn't occur to me to use them until I actually just looked at the Wikipedia entry as preparation for this podcast. So Sentinel nodes are sort of special separate entries in your linked list that are before the beginning and the ending entries. And so that way you don't have to worry about setting your previous and next pointers to nil when something becomes the beginning entry, because you just set it to the sentinel node at the beginning or at the end. And I'm curious if that would have made a lot of difference. It still
seems fiddly.
It'd still be fiddly. Yeah. And then I would have an extra thing to keep track of instead of just nil. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to add them in now, but it's something for other people to think about, it, I guess. And, you know, it's in terms of advice for other people, well, I guess mainly, you know, don't do it unless you really have to.
Yeah.
It's the big one. I found it to be useful to do it, but, you know, if you don't need exactly what I needed, if you don't need those references to the individual elements and you don't have to fiddle with those indexes, you could probably get away with just using a mutable array mm-hmm. yourself. And but you know it, so I have now used one in anger, and it went okay. Mm-hmm. So what is your? So you said you've used them some. Well,
oh, I've used them extensively. We could do another half an hour on linked lists. Yeah. But highlights for me is that I too have written linked lists in Coco. It's, as you've noticed, they are far less common in Coco. With Objective-C and other kind of higher level languages, much more common in languages like C and Pascal. What I ended up writing it for is sounds similar to what you did in it was a drag and drop implementation of an outline view, and you could grab arbitrary nodes and drag them into arbitrary places. And it turns out that when you are rearranging things, when you're keeping track of things by indexes, and then you have a list of indexes to change, things get really complicated really quickly. And so if you just can refer to items by the reference themselves instead of having to refer to them by the index, then the ordering problems just basically go away. So what I am doing is, and I actually even searched my code, my online hard drive and offline hard drives for this, because I want to bring it up and take a look at it again. I couldn't find it. So it's like a deja code thing here where I've definitely written this. I swear I've written it. I remember the code, but I couldn't find it anymore. But I would not hesitate to try it again. But it ended up being I think I call it like JR element, node element or something like that. And the idea is that it would be constructed from an array. And then you could refer to things in terms of nodes, and then you could turn that back into an array, because those arrays are far more common, far more useful in the general case. So in that case, you're just doing the transformation to make the transformation to your linked list, so you can then make the transformations you need to make, which sounds kind of meta, easier to follow and the code much cleaner. And so I found that very worthwhile. So back in the classic Mac OS, intrusive lists were the norm. So this is before, you know, the kids today have collection classes. But back in my day, we only had two bits. now we have an NS array of NS windows. But back then, you had a window record that had a pointer to the next window record, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite parts of the classic Mac OS was this thing called the queue utilities. So Apple actually had this implementation of a doubly linked list. Oh, was it doubly or singly? Maybe singly now that I think about it.
I totally don't remember this at all.
Yeah, yeah. So this is what the file manager and basically the I/O system and the classic Mac OS used for keeping track of all your outstanding jobs. And it was actually really cool. And it also had the benefit where it would also disable interrupts while it was rearranging the list, so that way it was you wouldn't be screwed up at interrupt time. And so I liked the queue utility so much in that I wanted to use it everywhere. So I ended up writing a software package, I guess not software package, a source code package called Elemental that implement an intrusive doubly linked list. And I just searched for it online, and I don't know if I've ever actually posted it, so maybe I'll just have to, you know, throw it up on GitHub just for laughs. I actually end up using it, I think, 4 years ago for something else.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But it was like, I think there was like one weird Mac, like classic Mac OS thing in there. But other than that, it was completely portable. It's just loaded with assertions and stuff like that. So it's a pretty nice package. So I'll just have to post it. Finally, my Atomicity package that does atomic stuff, which, oddly enough, I don't know if we ever actually talked about Atomicity very much on this show, but it's a big topic of mine. And in my MacHack paper, I ended up, I think, doing new research on how to implement atomic queues on PowerPC that had to do with taking atomic stacks and then flipping them on axis so they would act like atomic queues and stuff like that. So I don't think that source goes online either, so I will probably have to dig that up eventually. And pose a, so two packages I've written, so you can see.
All of our lists are lost.
That's pretty much it. You know, it's amazing how poor this stuff used to be. And now that we went this one notch higher, that we actually have collection classes that are supplied by language vendors, all these problems went away. Then they should have gone away a long time ago. I mean, the very fact that we were dealing with like window records that were pointing to each other. I mean, don't get me wrong, the 120K was amazingly resource constrained. It's amazing it could do what it could do at all. But yeah. The fact we were dealing with this in the 90s, it was just really inexcusable. But I've pared myself down so we can stop talking about linked lists.
You can stop enumerating your lost software packages.
There we go.
Here we go. Alrighty. So we'll see you next time.